Hello and welcome to Real Professional, the podcast where professionals have really professional conversations about the gaming industry. I am DreadXP Rock on Tour, Jan Solstrom, joined today by no one. Ted and Abby are at the Game Developer Conference 2022, so this week I've asked our editor Vince to get together some of our best clips in the spirit of GDC. You'll be getting advice about developing games, marketing games, all of our best bits talking about the games industry with developers, with musicians, with artists. So just kick back and enjoy these really great clips, and DJ, drop that sick beat.
So, you know, when we released the first collection, we had some people, you know, comment, hey, there's no key rebinding, I can't play this game. And I was like, oh, I feel so bad about this. So I went back to all the devs and I was like, hey, can we add key binding? And they're like, that's going to take a lot of work. And my schedule's filled up, because the way that we do the collections is that, you know, it's a pretty tight time frame. And the first collection, my budget was like, you know, so low on it. Not to say anything bad about my financiers. It's just like, you know, it was my first time, hadn't proved myself. So, you know, we didn't have the money to go back and like pay for another couple weeks of development to kind of get it done. And, you know, so, you know, basically I had to go back and be like, hey, I'm really sorry. I just did not know. I promise that in all the future titles, it will be, you know, have those accessibility features. And, you know, and every time since, when I go to the developers, it's a new collection, we have a new batch of developers, and I say, hey, you know, we need to have this and this and this, you know, key rebinding, subtitles, things like that. And they're like, well, that's going to be too much work. And I'm like, okay, well, we need it for people that are like disabled, you know, have some kind of accessibility issue. And they're like, oh, and there's never any fight from that point. You know, it's like the switch flips in their brain. And I think that that's a really, like, it's interesting, because when you bring up these features, it's like, when you make people realize that it's not an extra bell and whistle, but it's actually something that'll allow someone to experience their art, it's almost like it completely, like, there's no friction there. It's just whoop, 180, you know what I mean?
Exactly. It's, you know, it's like I said before, like, game developers want gamers to play their games. And once they figure out that they've unintentionally, and like I said, it's almost always unintentionally, block someone from playing it, like, they want to fix it. They want to know how. They want people to play their games.
I think a good example of a feature becoming a core mechanic or a core option, and what I'm hoping happens with other accessibility options, is first-person shooters having colorblind mode. That used to be one of those strange things where you're like, huh, colorblind mode. Now it's in every first-person competitive shooter that you play, and it's just an expected feature. I'm hoping that moving forward, that these accessibility options become just part of the game and not a feature, just a core mechanic, if that makes sense.
I want it to go even further. So, yeah, there's a colorblind mode, right? But that's because they made a choice that the default UI wasn't going to be colorblind friendly. Like, we need to take it a step further and just, why just not make the core UI colorblind friendly so you don't have to add an option? Like, why do we have to sort of unintentionally other or segregate people because they need an option? There was actually an amazing talk at the conference about this by Cherry Thompson called Pausing and Peering into the Distance, if people want to check it out. And Cherry, who is also an accessibility program manager at Ubisoft, did a great job of breaking down like how the games industry could go further by, again, making these choices early on to reduce the need of options. So like, that's what like my challenge, like, no, I don't want you to have colorblind mode, because I just want you to be colorblind friendly. Like, in games, we kind of hit that early, like, people are aware now. They know that they need to make sure colorblind players can't play. Well, now let's be intentionally inclusive of colorblind players and not, you know, remove the need of going into a menu and using different options.
Yeah, actually, that's a really, really good point. And that's literally, I was just about to say the same thing, which is, personally, I've just kind of adopted it as part of my design philosophy. So I don't know if you've played the most recent DreadX collection, The Hunt, but, you know, I worked with Nate Behrens on that, who is a really, really great game designer. And but I did the level design and kind of the quest design for it and stuff. And there were several occasions where I did something so that there would be a visual cue to go alongside the audio cue. Like, for example, when the generator stops working and the lights turn red, rather than just having it be like an alarm going off, I was like, no, it needs to do that so that we can depict to visually impaired hearing impaired players that something is going on. And like, it's really interesting because it actually leads to some better game design in general, because oftentimes game designers, and this is for all you game designers out there, your objectives are more obvious to you than they are to the player by like a long shot. And if you wonder why so many games nowadays feel so handholdy, it's because of the fact that, you know, there's a wide variety of gamers that are, you know, some of them are better at picking up on the tropes and the what the game expects than others. But, you know, there's ways that you could build your signaling to the player that is multi-layered so that people can pick up on whatever they're best at picking up on, be it because that's just who they are or because of some kind of prohibitive kind of disability. And I think that, you know, once you start thinking about it that way, it makes your design actually better, and not even just from an accessibility standpoint. I mean, that's a good thing, but just from a flat game design standpoint.
I have a mildly serious question about Haunted PS1, kind of in general. With, you know, a lot of these conventions and expos going full online, do you think things like the, their EEC3 showcase, you think things like that are kind of filling the space left by these bigger conventions? And to wit, does that provide more exposure for the indie devs out there?
So yes and no. It is great to see, you know, groups kind of banding together and doing this kind of thing. Even Dread, you know, doing this thing where you guys are raising awareness for pretty much anybody that's trying to be a creative individual and everything. And it's great to see people having that light shined on them. However, like I myself, like I had mentioned with my art style and everything, if I post something that I personally really like for example, for anybody that follows me, I made a pair of like, robot hands, basically like rotating around like this glowing girl who's dancing. And it was just something that I personally really liked in terms of its presentation and in using the camera work that I was doing for it. But like posting that, you know, on like my Twitter and like other places, it did really well. And then I would post that into like Haunted PS1. And because it wasn't like that crunchy aesthetic, a lot of people just kind of, you know, like shoot it away. And I was like, yeah, I mean, that it feels like, to give these individuals, you know, this big of a voice is a little bit concerning, in other words, because it can choose who to highlight. And that's a little bit scary. And I do think that there's somewhat more of an intention of fairness from somebody like, for example, I'm going to probably mispronounce the name, but Jeff Keighley in, you know, the Game Awards, you know, there's a not only the social voice, but there's like selected, curated choices being made as opposed to it be, again, you know, five individuals that are choosing. I don't want to say power tripping, but you know what I mean?
So it's kind of an issue of adherence to a certain visual aesthetic can at times become more of an identity than a stylistic choice.
Yeah, like when we look at, you know, games, there's, you know, so many different styles and unique things out there and everything. Just the same as like, if I were to like simplify it with like tattoos, you know, there's like a thousand different types of tattoos that you can get, but there's, you know, very specific genres of like what you can actually, you know, artistically draw in. And to like be a judge in that field and be like, oh, I only like new school tattoos, and then to judge everything else as crap or whatever, or not give it, you know, that fair shot. It makes those artists not want to go in that style and perfect that style, but rather change themselves and fall into the natural. And that's, I feel, disappointing. But again, this would be like nitpicking, I suppose. Maybe I'm just being too particular.
Yeah, I think that it's perfectly fine to build a community around an aesthetic. I love the PS1 aesthetic because it's kind of like the thing right now. Because a lot of us,
oh yeah, and it's great.
Yeah, are of the age that we grew up with. You know, other than Abby, who's 14, we all kind of grew up with that crunchy PS1 aesthetic, and I love to see a group of people bringing it and modernizing it for a new audience, and I hope it stays going for a while.
But at the same time, I think with that said, like, I myself, like, you know, we had mentioned it earlier, I'm just slightly younger than you, right? So, like, there was slight differences in terms of, like, how I was raised when it came to having more time on, say, like, the Xbox, the original Xbox and or, like, Dreamcast, mostly because of, like, money things. But there's a noticeable difference in terms of the assets from like a Dreamcast or an original Xbox game to that crunchy PlayStation 1 aesthetic. And, and you know, like I personally love an original Xbox game. Like those style games really hit it home for me. And, you know, I feel like if I were to like put a ton of time into a game that met that style, I feel like I would get a lot of feedback that would be like, oh, I should have just been a little bit more crunchy or something, you know? And it's just like, that's, mm-hmm. I don't know. It can be disappointing or discouraging in a way.
So, Abby, Ted, did either of you play Horror Tales the Wine? I reviewed it. I mean, I did my due diligence.
I have, yes. I have played Horror Tales the Wine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, talk about, like, that game, just like, can we just for a second talk about how pretty that game is? Like, sometimes I would just get caught like looking at the surrounding like areas and I'd forget I was playing a game. It just looks so pretty.
Well, thank you. Actually, that's totally done on purpose because I think making a pretty and beautiful and colorful horror game is the best provocation to the player that you can actually do, because you're aware you're playing a horror game, but at the same time, it's beautiful. And your mind is like, okay, it's gone, it's beautiful, we're fine. But you know you are not fine. And I am kind of sick of horror games taking place, you know, in a haunted mansion or a broken, forgotten hospital. And it's like there can be beauty in horror, if you ask me. And my last game, Infernium, a lot of the comments are also the same, like, hey, this is a very beautiful, it's not exactly horror, but it's a very beautiful horror game for its genre. So yeah, I'm very happy you find it beautiful, and the next horror game is going to be equally or even more beautiful, or at least I'll try it to be.
I mean, that your favorite thing about it is that, you know, it does that mix of color, right? Like you're mm-hmm. so tired of horror games being just like the same, either the same filter that we're all used to by now, or the same kind of palette of like sepia tone, yeah. Blah, you know?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And it's super true though, because it's like, sometimes certain games will have cool mechanics or like puzzles or something, but they're instantly just not as exciting for me when it is taking place in those common horror themes like the house or the hospital. So, I mean, your game was definitely a nice, it was a good big breath of fresh air.
This is, I am actually about to cry by hearing you say that those things, because I also teach in the University of Barcelona. And one thing I always say to my students is, use the local shit we have here. I don't mind if it's shit from Europe, from Spain, from Catalonia, from your tone, but we try to imitate American culture, and there's nothing wrong with American culture, but it's not surprising anymore. Everyone has mm-hmm. seen those settings, and if we have something here that we can, like, for example, the whole motto of the hotel, the wine, it's based on a Mediterranean island. And why not? Why can't there be horror in a Mediterranean island? It's not about the setting. It's about how it is presented to you, and I hope it's memorable because of this. In the game, you also explore a broken mansion, and it's actually a traditional Catalan masia, and some things that are, you know, more similar to other settings in the horror genre. But I think it's. Like, if we open, like, for example, I would love a horror game that is set in African or tribal African culture. You know, something similar that what Marvel did with Black Panther, this kind of mm-hmm. architecture and setting, I think that would be so transgressive, and it could work very, very well, because all the stories about witchcrafts that are set in Africa, those are amazing. And no, I don't think there's a single person in this world that would say, no, I only buy horror games that are set in dark American ruined hospitals. So I think there's a lot of ground to expand the genre here.
I think that's an excellent approach that a lot of developers need to take these days, and that is horror can happen anywhere. It's a universal thing. It is not strictly... an American export. We don't send our... I prefer if we didn't send our horror to other countries. It's like, here's your spooky VHS filter hospital with PS1 graphics. Here you go. Here's your American horror. I remember the first time I saw the Wine Sea, I had to stop and I was like, holy shit. Like, we're really just doing this, huh? There's been a lot of talk. Ted and I get onto this subject a lot whenever it comes to Twitter. And it's something that I wanted to talk about so that the listeners of the podcast can kind of know where we're coming from on this. Stop trying to market your game to game devs.
Yeah. Yeah, I tend to agree with that. I mean, the average game purchaser has no clue how a game is made. All they care about is how a game is played. Yeah, I agree with that on a surface level, but I wonder if you have any like examples you can mention, because I agree, but like that is something that I've like established for myself so long ago that I need a refresher on how you see it.
Well, the thing is, on Twitter, a lot of game devs, and you see these small game dev collectives, and since you did with stuff with Huegos Rancheros, the mm-hmm. Austin Collective, if you're exclusively targeting your stuff towards other members of your collective and thinking, you know, based on their positive feedback that you have something going, I feel like that's a false equivalency. Just because people in your circle of game devs like what you're making does not mean they'll buy it. I'll let Ted kind of expand on that, because he's got a very good, you know, he runs a game company, so he's got a very good take on that. But my take is just essentially, if you're dealing with your circle only and not expanding out, you might feel like you're going to sell a lot of games because you have, you know, hundreds of people saying this looks great. But if they're game devs, they're probably not going to buy your game.
Yeah, I mean, you have to like always look at Abby. Did you want to go? I heard you chime in.
I was just gonna say, even like the gaming community in general. I was thinking about this just like last night. Like the indie horror gaming community in general. If you include like content creators, people who just like to play the games, and then also like other game developers and publishers and stuff. Like that community is still super small in the grand scheme of things. Like if you really want to do well, like you got to step outside of that too. You know, like. Reach bigger gaming communities, but also like go outside of gaming communities. Like there's a whole population of people that are interested in games but don't necessarily play them, or like, you know, just like to watch footage of them. You know, the world is so big, and like in comparison, we're a pretty small community.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is something I've been able to, like, you know, gauge at conventions, and I incorporated it into our online stuff, is I used this thing that I liked to call, like, the nod consistency, where you, whenever anyone approaches your booth at a convention, you have no clue whether or not they are someone's mom who brought their teen, who's just, you know, happy to be there, or if they're a seasoned game developer. And so what I tend to do is I start at the lowest, like, possible description of a game, and I drip more complex, like, terminology as I talk to them. And, you know, they're nodding along the whole time. And the second I see that nod slow down, that's how I know I've, like, gotten too far in the weeds of game jargon. And that's where I, like, plateau myself and, you know, rein back my comparisons to other games, or rein back, you know, like, I'm not going to use the word isometric in this sentence. You know, I can tell that is not going to be a word because I don't want to have to explain that. And this person doesn't care to learn it. Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree.
I start every explanation of a game whenever someone says, like, we recently released Sucker for Love. If someone comes to me and I don't know them from Adam, and they say, what is Sucker for Love? And it's easy. I just say, it's the Dark Souls of dating games.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
It's the Breath of the Wild of Dark Souls likes.
It's the Crash Bandicoot of Deadpool.
I love that.
Yes,
that,
yes.
The Dark Souls of and Breath of the Wild like have become so ingrained in the discourse.
No, totally. Totally. There's a strange, I think that is a totally workable thing. We have a weird vibe at Finji, or at least, like, I've kind of implemented a weird vibe at Finji where I, on the other hand, like, don't like to use comparisons at all. Like, you know, a lot of people take Tunic and they say, oh, look at this. It's like Legend of Zelda. But I would never say that because, one, like, yeah, no, it totally looks like Legend of Zelda, right? Like, little dude, green tunic, colorful world, bright colors, yes. But if you go into Tunic expecting a Legend of Zelda game, you're going to be disappointed. And to your point, it is more of a Souls game than a Zelda game. But if you want a Zelda game for Finji, play Chicory, A Colorful Tale. And it's this mentality that I picked up when I was in college. I had a professor who talked about Coke versus Pepsi. And she said, watch a Coke commercial and watch a Pepsi commercial. The Coke commercial will be about having a good time and enjoying a drink. And the Pepsi commercial will always be about comparing themselves to Coke. And that's why Coke is the leader, is because they have the swagger to not need to ever compare themselves to a competitor. And Pepsi is always going to be second place because they're always, like, reminding you that Coke exists.
Mm-hmm. So you're kind of, in my research, you're kind of new on the scene as a game developer.
Yeah, in terms of releases, yeah. I released my first game in 2020. How I started game development is, it's literally just, it was one sentence from my dad, and I just started, and it sort of led me into this rabbit hole. I remember playing on my laptop, playing just a bunch of games, and my dad was like, hey, since you play so many games, why don't you make some? And I said, oh, silly dad, I'm not a game developer. He said, look it up on the internet, how to become a game developer. And I said, huh. And 5 years later, here we are.
Well, how old were you when you had this conversation with you?
How old was I?
Yeah.
I was 14.
Yeah, so you're still young. I mean, you're like 19 now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, you started young, you know, and you have a lot left. It's not like you started when you were 32 5 years ago. You
know? Yeah, yeah. Definitely. I mean, I don't know, just starting while you're young is definitely better. Since I got to choose a really good high school. It doesn't work the same as in America. I'm sure, like, nobody knows this, but, like, here, how you guys choose your college is based on your profession, what you want to be. Here, you choose your high school based on your profession, what you want to be. So there's specific high schools for programming, web design, architecture, whatever, right? And I didn't know, I had no clue what I wanted to do in life. And so I discovered programming. I was like, hey, this is pretty cool. And because when I was about to turn 15, I had to choose a high school. Coincidentally, there was also a new program for programming in, like, a high school. So I was like, oh, I'll sign up for that. Best decision I ever made. Absolutely. It was so good. Definitely worth it. I recommend it. If anyone is you know, wondering what they want to do and they live in Croatia, I definitely recommend going to web programming high school.
I always respect people that can go through like the academic route, because like so many people now, I mean, well, I won't say now, but so many people for so long have been just kind of like self-taught. And this new infrastructure, though, of like actually learning through an institution how to do game design rather than just like straight programming or coding is rather interesting. So how would you you're in school for game design specifically or for programming?
No. Technically, my field is web programming, not web design, but web programming. But we do a lot of stuff like Android apps and like games and stuff like that. Specifically, we haven't actually done Unity because Unity is object oriented. It's like C#, so we don't really do that in my school. We mainly focus on JavaScript and like website type stuff and like apps and that sort of stuff. So in terms of game development, I was self-taught, but in terms of like programming in general, school has actually helped me a lot to become a much better programmer.
Yeah, I imagine. I mean, game design is one of those things where like you'd think that the skills are just like straight programming and like coding and stuff, but there's a lot more that goes into it. So like, in what ways did you have to learn things on your own versus what you learned kind of in the classroom?
So really, in terms of like making games, I really learned a lot of that in terms of like game design from other games. Like, for example, when I first worked on Nucalypse, I played Half-Life, and I sort of noticed everything, like how they like, for example, you'd walk into a room, you'd go right, you'd notice the exit, you'd go there. And then I wondered, why did I go right? Why didn't I not go straight? You know? So like, it was like either the lighting or just, I don't know. Like, I was really intrigued by that, how you can pretty much trick people into doing what you want them to do in a game and give them the sort of appearance of choice, but actually you're sort of like leading them without actually leading them. That's how I usually describe game design, where people are like, oh, like, what's game design? You're like, you're pretty much like telling people how to beat the game without actually telling them. You're subtly being there with, you know, lighting, audio cues, visuals, whatever, right?
So that's an extremely good point, because that's one of the things we constantly tell our developers, mm-hmm. is that, like, you know, with games, you can't just assume that the player knows where to go or what to do. Like, you know what to do because it's your game, but you have to make things exceptionally accessible. And that's what the core of game design is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Like, as for school, really, we haven't touched game design. Farthest we've gone from game design is like making a Flappy Bird game on Android. So in terms of that, like, I'm not really, you know, from school, I haven't really learned a lot about that. But I do have a senior project coming up in 3-4 months that I have to finish. And it's in Unity, and it's like a multiplayer game, like a racing game. And like, your final project has to be something related to programming, but it doesn't have to be something that we learned in those 4 years of high school. And so, you know, I sort of chose Unity because I love Unity. Okay, it's great. Absolutely amazing. I remember one time we had an Android project and I used Unity, and I literally, in my documentation that you have to write usually how like everything works, I wrote, why did I choose Unity? And then I just wrote, Android sucks, Unity is better. And therefore, I chose Unity. I got an F, but it didn't matter because, you know, she said, oh, I can't accept this because it's not in Android. It's Unity for Android. But I said, but it's still Android. She's like, no, but you have to use Android Studio. And so I just gave up and got an F.
Sometimes that's what you got to do. Yeah, no. I mean, I think that, but now we're getting into the debate of how to best implement it. Whereas I think that when I look at, like, NFT stuff, it's like right now the current zeitgeist in a lot of the gaming community is like, never fucking do it. I will not work for a company that does it. We are never going to do it. And I think that it's interesting because that was that level of vitriol that we see in a lot of communities now for NFTs is the same vitriol that we saw for microtransactions and is the same vitriol we saw for DLC. It's also the same vitriol we saw for like DRM back in the day. I don't know if anyone's still debating about DRM at this point.
I don't think anyone likes DRM.
Real quick, I will call out Techland. I love Techland. Like, don't get me wrong. I think they're an excellent company. But I had that internet outage around the time that Dying Light 2 launched. And I had the game previously for review. But, and I had played it about 40 hours, and I went to start it without internet, and it's like, oh, sorry, you know, it patched a day before release, and we added some anti-piracy measures, so now the game's got to verify online before you can play it. And it's like, oh, thanks. Thanks, Techland, for adding that in a day before launch.
Yeah, it's pretty, yeah. And it's so funny, because there's, like, all these, like, features that, like, people have, like, had issues with before, and that some of them have, like, gotten smoothed over. Some of them have, like, are better than they used to be, because it used to be that, like, some DRM would just, like, fucking crash your computer. Like, I remember back in the early days when I was playing, like, Bet on Soldier and shit like that. That's an old fucking game. That's probably older than you are. And, like, the DRM for that would just destroy some computers. And, like, there's been these, like, kind of cycles of, like, you know, horse armor being... It's so funny, though, that, like, we're still, like, horse armor is still the go-to, oh, I guess go-to for people my fucking age about, you know, DLC that's bad, when realistically now they sell horse armor for even more expensive than that in basically every game on the fucking planet.
What's horse armor? I remember being something like crazy.
Oh my god, I feel so fucking old right now. Horse armor.
Like $4.99?
Yeah, it was like $5.
And it was kind of like the first foray into paid DLC with Oblivion, and it's like... horse armor, and people... So I've got a very old man mindset. I'm 32. And for a long time, I hated the idea of DLC, and I hated all of that, paying for that microtransactions. And I thought, whenever I was younger, and I pull out my suspenders from my chest, and I let them snap back down. And I go, whenever I was younger, you bought a game and it was finished. And that is true, to some extent, whenever I would buy a game on the PlayStation 2, or on the Super Nintendo, or on my original PlayStation, that was the game. That was what you got. And now I look at it today, and I look at post-launch cycles and things like that, continued support from the developers long after launch, and it made me realize, you know, maybe it's not a bad idea to kick them some extra money for DLC. And it all comes down to a question of intent. Whenever you look at on-disc DLC, they can fuck off. Like, you made it during the development cycle of this game? Fuck off. Like, I don't like that. But to go back to Techland, the original Dying Light, they came through with one of the biggest and most meaningful pieces of DLC, The Following, which is essentially a whole standalone campaign on par with the original full game. And that's DLC that wasn't on the disc. It was something they made afterwards. And their support continuing on past release is one of the best in the business. They've already said that they're going to do five years of post-launch content for Dying Light 2. So I think it all comes down to intent, and also I have to look at that post-launch support. You know, if you bought Red Faction on the PlayStation 2 in 2005, 2004, whatever, that was it. That was the game. That was all of it. No one was doing no post-launch support, and you go back as far as the Nintendo 64... If something was wrong with that game, you had to do another full-ass printing of the game cartridge, or people just had to deal with it. And I think we take for granted the post-launch support that we're afforded these days by developers.
Right. I mean, the downside of our techno-dystopia that we currently live in is, you know, that we're going to get nickeled and dimed for everything until we're reduced to husks of humans. And that's the dark timeline. But the positive timeline is that, like, you know, we are now able to do things with games we were literally never able to before, like live service games and things like that. And sure, there's the bads of it, but there's also the goods of it. Like, there are, like, I guess that, like, EverQuest has been around for what, Abby? You're playing EverQuest right now. It was 37 years.
Yeah, it's been around for a while.
Since, but yeah,
the 90s, I believe.
Yeah, but even EverQuest has, like, adopted a lot of, you know, what we can do with online accessibility now. You know, you don't have to go to the store and buy a disc every time there's a new expansion, you know. That's so quaint to even think about. Like, when's the last time I bought a PC game in a fucking store, you know?
And I totally, it's funny you should mention that, Ted, because I was, like, downloading, like, a private EverQuest server recently, and I totally forgot. Remember when you used to, like, get games, and they came with, like, 6 or 7 discs sometimes, and you're downloading shit, and time to insert disc number 2, and you're like, all right, here we go. Well, you know, I found, like, a free downloadable version online of that, and so you had to do it in your files, though, instead of actually inserting a disc. I don't even think computers come with disc holders anymore, but
I know, right?
I was like, what the fuck? I totally forgot this was a thing until recently. It just blows your mind.
Yeah, but I think that, you know, that's true. It's like so funny to like look back on the old days and be like, wow, this is like what we used to do just to like play our fucking games. And then like, oh God, you remember like the old days of trying to mod games was like, I don't know if this is going to break my entire game forever. Like every time you drop a mod in, you're like rolling those fucking dice. And now we have like Steam Workshops and mod managers. So there's, you know, there's like the progress has not only been negative. I think we tend to focus on the negatives and like the progress just because that's just kind of how like negativity sells. And but there's been like a lot of positives in the progress also. And, you know, the reason I'm bringing up Chronicles of Elyria as this like counterexample with like a game that we're like basically it to me smacks of a very much of a amateur fan project. It's like, hey, we are never going to do microtransactions in this game because that is our moral standpoint. We would rather waste your $9 million. And it's like a very closed-minded thing. Cause like if I got $9 million for a game, right, I am telling you that like, if I had to put microtransactions in the game to get over the line, I would do that because I owe that $9 million to the people that fucking supported me. You know, like I have to put my own bullshit in check. And the fact that they basically let their $9 million game die because of like this conviction against something that like, even people that don't like it are like, yeah, I mean, I can see it done well. And that's kind of how I'm like, but so I'm trying to apply that lens again with NFTs, but I just don't see it. Cause like, I don't see how NFTs are going to be the, and that's what people, a lot of people are saying is like, the reason I bring it up is because a lot of people are saying that like NFTs are going to be the, like they're here to stay. There's too many people already invested in it and companies like Ubisoft are already using it. So it's going to be there forever. And I'm like, I don't see that. Like, I don't see it like I do with DLC. Because, like, DLC, yes, it exists to make the company money, but it also exists to actually provide a useful service to the player when done right. Like, DLC can be done right. And if DLC is done right, people like it. If they don't like it, then you have, you know, another $100 Call of Duty Battle Pass that's going to give you four maps. And you go, okay, why did I spend $100 on this?
Well, it always starts as that, right? Like, I remember when Twitter was first a thing, and what did we use it for, right? Like, it was, like, goofing around in high school. You know, it was goofing around in middle school. It was goofing around, you know? Like, it's the kids. Whenever, like, a new app comes out, the kids are the first ones to, like, get their hands on it, you know?
And, yeah.
Which is,
and like,
you know, for some, you know, like, in some perspectives, like, unfortunate. And, you know, like, when it comes to, like, how much of the Wild West the internet is. But, mm-hmm. you know, in other perspectives, too, that's always been the case with advancements in technology.
Advancements in anything. They used
to want to get their hands on it.
Yeah, for sure. Like, any advancement in any, like, industry or popular group is going to attract the kiddos. I remember,
the
youth though,
hold the reins on culture. You know?
That's yeah, and they make things popular too. That's a big key. But I remember back when Twitter, when I first got a Twitter when I was younger, it was like the place where like people in high school or middle school just were being like expressing their emotions and stuff. And I never thought a day in my life that when I grew up, I would actually use Twitter for any professional thing.
Right.
So it is interesting to see how attracted professional businesses and professional beings, whether they be in any kind of group of people, like musicians, politicians, etc. Like, it's crazy to see how it's actually being used for a serious thing, because most of my life I've looked at Twitter as a place where like, uh-oh, Beth wants to do this one thing again, or Beth is bragging about this thing again. It's just like some girl that you go to like high school with or like middle school, and you never actually talk to this person. It's the only way you interact with people on like an outside stance. So it's just interesting because it went from very minimalistic attributes to now, you know, we have presidents that are tweeting and stuff like that.
TikTok is just on the way to being the same thing.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Social media
it's
platforms,
inevitable.
Yeah, they grow up just like people do. The median age goes up, and a lot of it, and I was just previously saying, you know, Fortune 500 companies are, you know, doing good advertising on TikTok, but at the same time, they're kind of fucking it up
for everyone else, because the biggest thing in marketing a game or getting on socials is like that feeling of community and that feeling of authenticity. I'm not coming at this from a standpoint, like I know the data, I know the analytics, I know all the numbers, but whenever I sit down to post something, I'm not thinking about that. I'm thinking, I want to show you this cool thing that one of the devs made. Like, and I hope you think it's as cool as I do. That's my genuine earnest feeling, is I want you to see this cool fucking thing because I think it's very cool.
Right.
And if you come at it from that place of earnestness and authenticity, it just, you know, everybody likes people to be honest with them. And that even comes down to their game companies. Yeah, Dread XP is a business. We publish games. We make money from those published games. The developers make money. The support staff makes money. But at the end of the day, we all just want to show you a cool fucking thing that someone made.
Yep.
That's why we're here. That's why we're in the business.
Yeah, I want to... Mm-hmm. And
that's also why we're indie.
Yeah, and companies that come at it from, I want to sell you something. Like, their immediate standpoint is, I want to sell you a product or an experience. Fuck them.
I got two words for that. Silence, yeah. Brand.
Yeah, fuck know, them. Like, I do, I run brand accounts. They are the accounts for our brand. But whenever you interact with them and someone replies to you and someone wants to know how you're doing, that's one person. That's me. I'm just seeing how you're doing. You know, I reply to a lot of the dumb comments on TikTok because if you just drop this stuff out here and go, I'm not going to interact with the community that I've built around this product, and I just want to sell them something, I need that fucking money, you're an asshole. Like, you're yes. An asshole. I would love to meet every single fan, all of them, and give them a high five because they've checked out the cool shit that is made by the company.
Right.
And that whole, like, I know Ted's not here, but that's like the whole philosophy. Surround yourself with your homies and then go do cool shit together.
Absolutely.
And that's how he's always run it.
That brings up a really good point. Like,
hit me with that good point, Cleveland.
Hell yeah. It's that, and it's my favorite thing about it. It's like the other piece of advice, apart from, you know, if we're giving advice out. If we're giving advice out there, like if you don't want to do the social media side of it, like of your indie game that you're working on, then find a publisher, like, or find like a colleague or a friend or a peer who believes in you and work on it with them, and get someone who does love social media, who can do it authentically like Jans can. Because at the end of the day, like, no one's an island. That's the whole point of social media. And we can build a cathedral together. And I personally really like cathedrals and using them as examples and metaphors. Like, because of my background studying frescoes, and there's ample room for that. But you know, there's a lot of different types of churches you can build. You know, you can build like a megalithic gothic cathedral, like a big AAA game, you know, or you can build like a family, like, small town church. And I think that we're, you know, somewhere in the middle on that. Or you can build like a terrible giant megalithic, you know, mega church or whatever, like whatever you want. But at a certain point, it starts to feel like with smaller games too, that like it's just one person like worshiping in their room, you know, like, which is fine too. Like, there's not, that's great also. But for me, like, for what I want, it's to build like a really pretty church in like our little town, you know, like that, you know, you can see the spire up over the hill, you know, like, and it's ornamented and it's beautiful, but it's enjoyed by like a nice, small, pretty community. And I don't know, there's something really gratifying about that. You can name all the people who worked on it. You can, you know, we're all in this together. And I love churches of any kind, though. I'm happy to help, you know, build whatever.
Cleveland, are you trying to get us to join a cult?
Yeah,